And welcome to National Treasure Hunt, the podcast where the secret lies not only with Charlotte, but also with your co-hosts. I'm Aubrey.
And I'm Emily.
And I am here to break National Treasure Edge of History once again.
I feel like our goal should not be to break the show.
Okay, it's just happening naturally a lot this season.
It scares me. I'm spoiler alert, I don't know what Aubrey's gonna tell me in this episode, so all my reactions are gonna be genuine, so I don't know how she's going to break Edge of History, but I guess we'll find out together.
We will. I'm so excited about it, to be honest, because I will be giving a little history lesson to you, Emily, and to our listeners today about a figure, a historical figure that is referenced in Edge of History, and that would be Sor Juana. So that's what we're going to be doing today in our penultimate episode of season 8. What?
I literally, when we went to record this, saw the episode number and was like, what?
Yeah. Where did the season go?
Yeah.
It's pretty wild and pretty unbelievable, but we are here with some great content for you for this penultimate episode. But before we get there, y'all, you know what we have to do. We have to dive deep into the Parkington Lane pit. These are our screams from Parkington Lane. All right, Em, how has National Treasure destroyed your life recently?
I'd like to think that it's enhanced it.
That's beautiful.
Thank you. I went out to dinner recently, and while we were waiting for our reservation, we went into a Crate and Barrel. And, you know, they just have a bunch of furniture and, like, decorations and stuff there. And I kid you not, in the center of one of the tables was a very large bowl full of fake lemons.
Did you take a picture?
I did.
Oh my god, send it?
Yeah, I'll send it to you.
Okay, amazing. I love that scream.
Yep. So, lemons and Freemasonry are where I'm getting most of mine from, but we're gonna go with it.
Well, yo, mine is Freemason related this week. So my scream has to do with work. So where I work has like an educational institution kind of tied to it, and I periodically have to go there and give lectures. And I probably have to do this approximately quarterly. So I've been to this place a number of times. Last week, I'm driving there and I'm waiting at a traffic light right before the turn to get to the place. And I guess I'm feeling more observant than usual because I look up and right next to the complex for the educational institution is a building with a giant Freemason logo on it. And it turns out there's a Freemason lodge and it's been there next to this place that I have to go to for work. It has been there the whole entire time.
So you were being fairly unobservant before I started with all my Freemason sightings.
I think you might have been the reason why I am so attuned to Freemasonry these days, Emily.
I love that for me and for you.
Me too.
So if you have a scream to share like us, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at NT Hunt Podcast. We're also available at nthuntpodcast.com. Please go ahead if you have not and order our book, National Treasure Hunt, One Step Short of Crazy, at tuckerdspress.com. And go ahead and support us by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/nthuntpodcast. Now, this is a humble brag moment, but have you happened to notice how well our weekly meme series has been going, Aubrey?
The one on Patreon, I have. I giggle at it frequently.
Thank you. Yes. So if you are unaware, I make memes that are National Treasure adjacent, let's say, and we post them on the Patreon every week on Fridays to start your day off right. So if you want more of that, join the Patreon.
Yes, please do. Lots of content over there for you. But Emily, I think it is time for us to dive deep into the topic of Sor Juana. today. And for this episode, what I think we should do is kind of model this one a little bit like the Malinche episode we did earlier this season, where we started by reminding everyone of the context and edge of history, you know, why this historical figure is relevant. Then actually start the history lesson. Who was this person really? And then wrap up with like a segment that I like to call Edge of History versus History. So, what did Edge of History say that was right? What did they say that wasn't quite right? And generally, what can we learn about the show from this historical exercise? Does that sound right to you?
That sounds amazing, because I think all of those components are going to be super important for me.
Uh-oh, she doesn't remember who Sorwana
Was that the first question you were gonna ask me?
Yeah, okay, so here's the thing. Funnily enough, I, Emily, for a long time have felt that there are components in each National Treasure movie and now the show that in a split second, I will forget exist. So, for example, in the first movie, that is the Intrepid scene. In the second movie, I don't know, it's the whole part right before they go to Mount Rushmore. And then in Edge of History, for me, the scene that I forget is the whole component that takes place at the university, the former convent in Mexico City, where they actually find the third box. That's
Is
the
that
scene we're talking about today.
the one with the organ?
Yes.
Oh, I loved that scene.
But you don't remember Sorwana?
Was she the one that wrote the music?
No, that's Trevor Rabin. But
No, no. Like, was
No.
she the one that hit it in the organ? No. Maybe. We don't know. Maybe we're
Okay.
getting there.
We're gonna get to the point where Aubrey really thought that the show was implying Sorwana hid the box in the organ, but Aubrey is also going to prove that that's not freaking possible. But we'll get there.
Okay.
Maybe this will help, Emily. I'm gonna start by reminding you of the Edge of History actual story context here, because it's gonna be frankly, important for me that you remember this even a little bit so that I can ask you questions later about your perception of the scene, okay?
Sounds good.
Okay. So this comes up in the like latter half, latter th last third of the show. We know that Jess and her crew have gone to Mexico to confront Salazar in prison, only to find that the person imprisoned under the name Diego Salazar is actually Rafael Rios, Jess's father. We learn again that Rafael was arrested breaking into the bank where he thought the lapis or Incan box was located. Now, once Jess is actually communicating with her father in prison, you know, after the initial shock of who he actually is wears off, Raphael shares that the box wasn't under where this bank was. The Daughters of the Plumed Serpent had moved the box previously. And he gives Jess a clue. Why? I don't know. Maybe he didn't know what it meant. I like to think he knew what it meant, but for some reason wasn't telling her because Raphael does a lot of questionable things in this show. Regardless, the clue he gives Jess is this: go to the place where the first Queen of Spain and Saint Jerome met and passed notes.
I remember that.
You do. Okay. Because we like this, right? Because it has an intersection reference, it has like a here at the wall vibe to it.
Yeah, and also notes.
Which we'll get to the organ. Exactly. So Jess and I think it ends up being Ethan crack the code to mean an intersection of two streets, Queen Isabella and San Geronimo. And it turns out that at this intersection is a university that was formerly the convent of Sor Juana, a woman who Edge of History describes as the first feminist of the New World. And they imply that that's a basically a good reason for them to think that the box is at this convent, because Sor Juana, the first feminist of the New World, like this was her spot. So they go on a tour of the old convent, thinking that the relic is hidden there, and they end up being right. In the chapel, they do end up discovering the old organ that you love, Emily.
Yes, organ, organ, organ. Do you know I went to organ concerts at Ursinus?
Yes.
Oh, you did know I did that? Yeah, probably because it was like Sunday afternoon. You'd be like, "Where are you going?" And I'm like, "Oh, to the organ concert." And you were like, "There's an organ concert," and I was like, "Yes." And then I would
I
be
was
there
a
for like.
tour guide. We knew all the stats about how the Heaton Memorial Organ is like the biggest pipe organ on the East
Well,
Coast.
yeah, but they had concerts there all the time.
Yeah, and you went and toured inside of the organ. Blah, 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 blah.
That was in a music class.
Anyway, the organ was apparently the organ that Sor Juana played. So Tasha, who apparently plays piano, goes to the organ, plays Jess's mom's lullaby,
We love music in
and
this show.
the notes of the song trigger like a series of gears inside the organ, ultimately revealing a compartment in the organ's pipe, and the relic is inside.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I will say that like the notes opening the different like pipes. Oh my, that was so cool to me. Do you remember us having a discussion about how I didn't think it was like super possible that that combination of notes had not been played before, slash that like, because wasn't it something with like the devil's tritone or something like that? No.
I have no idea. Maybe.
Maybe. Okay,
Couldn't
well.
tell you. You know, I know absolutely nothing about music.
I don't think that would be in a lullaby.
I too found this scene a little unrealistic, but cool. But clearly, Emily, for someone who loved this scene so much, it did not make an impression on you, given that you didn't remember the main historical figure invoked in the story.
No, I just remembered like the, because I'm it, to me it was akin to the Resolute Desk,
Which
like the
one?
in Buckingham Palace when they pull the little slats of the drawers
Huh, okay.
because it was like the clicking and then it opened something else. Like to me, that's what this was. And like because it was happening with music, that was so I was focused on the like the puzzle treasure hunt aspect, not the history aspect, which I feel like our listeners know is where I do not tend to shine.
Well, Emily, Edge of History really tried to give Sor Juana her moment in the sun. Clearly, they were not entirely successful if you are a stand-in, a Riley for the general audience of this show. So today, what I want to do is give Sor Juana her real moment in the sun and dive into who she actually was.
Does Sor Juana mean sun?
No. It means none. Wanna, like NUN.
Nun Juana?
Yes.
Nun Juana. Like ninja warrior. That's kind of what it sounds like to me.
Anyway, I was super excited about researching Sor Juana because I had genuinely never heard of her before. And I don't know about you, Em, that hasn't really happened for me with National Treasure Invoked History before. I feel like most of the things we talk about in the movies, I had at least heard of before, even if I didn't know the full story. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean about yourself. I think, yeah,
You've heard of Queen Victoria.
there are other things I had not heard of.
Okay. Well, I will say that in terms of Edge of History, I'll caveat this by saying I hadn't heard of La Malinche either, but she was at least tied to a historical event that I was familiar with, being like Cortez's expedition in Mesoamerica. You learned about the Aztecs, Emily. I know you did.
What? Oh, but that I learned about them in Spanish, like in that language. I did not retain much of that.
You didn't learn about the Aztecs in world history?
I probably did, but that was the world history class, probably where I was super anxious because it was in middle school and I did wasn't on medication. So I don't
Well,
know that I retained a lot. Aubrey, I don't think you understand. I did not do well in history classes. Like that, and I took AP European history and don't remember many of those things.
that's because you're not supposed to remember anything from EAP classes because they're teaching you to teaching to a test, and that's bad, bad teaching theory, blah, 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 blah. We know this. But I'm so glad that National Treasure Hunt has come into your life because I feel like it is coming at a great time for you to just really brush up on your US and world history knowledge.
Yes, and we can see how well that's gone by how well I remember all the historical facts.
Okay, you're really inspiring a lot of confidence in our listeners, I am sure.
They know me at this point. They know my flaws. I lay them out.
So anyway, it was really cool to be able to research this. And I would say, from my personal reflection, because Edge of History associates Sor Juana with a convent, my brain immediately goes to she was a nun. But it turns out that she was a poet and a scholar from Mexico. She was also a nun, but that isn't really what she's remembered for today, if that makes sense.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know how much nuns are remembered for if they're not like, if they don't become saints, maybe.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more of a traditional religious connotation, obviously, to nuns who are remembered in history. Sor Juana is definitely an exception. So Sor Juana was born Juana Inez de la Cruz, and she's from kind of just outside of Mexico City, born around November 12th, 1651. Though there is some kind of wiggle room in historical records, some believe she was born, I guess, 3 years earlier in 1648. Her mother was Creole, her father was Spanish, and she was immediately seen as academically gifted.
Oh, we love a smart woman.
You are going to love Sor Juana Emily, I swear. So, as a child, she started learning Greek, Latin, science, literature, poetry, literally as a kid. It was said that she wrote her first poem at 8 years old.
Like a good poem?
Let's say she will become a famous poet.
So probably.
Probably great for an 8-year-old.
Okay. So I was gonna say I wrote poems when I was 8, but I don't think they were great.
I would pay money to see those. If your mom has them, please have her send them to
Pretty
me.
sure there is one hanging up in our home.
Excellent. I look forward to seeing it. Anyway, it was said that Sor Juana was obsessive about studying and learning. And because she was a woman in this particular time period, she didn't really have access to a formal education. So she was largely self-taught. And think about that. Self-taught in topics like science and Greek and poetry. Like, can you imagine?
I barely made it through like organic chemistry being taught by you and our professors. Like, I don't know how you would self-teach that kind of stuff.
Well, get this. Her intellect was apparently so obvious and so like attention grabbing that the Viceroy of New Spain, basically like the S Spain's like on location governance structure in Mexico, if you will, the Viceroy had Sor Juana tested around age 17 by about 40 scholars of the time period to kind of be like, okay, is this girl legit? Turns out she was.
Wow. Okay, so like she had like a mini thesis
Yeah,
defense
it's like the
at
scariest
17.
thesis panel you have ever heard of.
Ooh, okay.
Like Manuela, no offense, Manuela, Manuela's got nothing on
Well,
Sor
she also
Juana here.
failed. I'm assuming Sor Juana passed with flying colors.
Well, yeah, I suppose you could say that. Again, this let's not confuse anyone. It wasn't actually a thesis defense. We're just analogizing because of our own personal traumas in the field. Okay, so Sorwana is like examined formally by a board of scholars. And it was said that she claimed she felt, and I'm going to quote Britannica here, a total disinclination to marriage, and that she wanted, quote, no fixed occupation which might curtail her freedom to study.
I have two thoughts here.
Please.
So, one, my immediate thought, because this is where my brain goes nowadays, is was she possibly like a closeted, like lesbian?
It's weird to me that that's the first place your brain goes, but continue.
But also, I'm seeing why entering into a nunnery or a convent would have been a convenient avenue for her to go to. So I'm assuming this is what led to her joining a convent.
100%. I will say that I cannot speculate on her sexuality. I don't think any historian probably can in good faith. But you're exactly right, at least on your second point, that she ended up in a convent starting in 1667, because this is a place where she would not feel any societal pressures to marry or to have children or anything like that. And she would be able to spend her time focused on her studies.
So 1667, she would have been between 16 and what, 18? No, 16 and 19.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So kind
So
of.
probably like after that testing.
Oh yes, for sure. That's kind of what I think led to it. And we'll learn that she so impressed the viceroy, and I believe his wife, or the next viceroy and his wife, the governing figures, that she would end up with some special privileges at this convent. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. So the convent of the Order of Saint Jerome in Mexico City, at the time of her being there, it was actually called the Convent of Saint Paula. This is the convent we're talking about in Edge of History lore. It was actually the second convent she went to. She was only at the first one for a very short amount of time. They were a lot more stringent and probably what you would expect from like a nunnery. But when she arrives at the convent of the Order of Saint Jerome, she'll end up staying here for the rest of her life.
Oh, wow.
So while she was there, she would spend most of her time studying, writing, and of course, also teaching the girls at the convent school, primarily in subjects like music and drama.
Love it.
Yeah, I knew you would love it. I'm telling you, you're gonna love her. But because she's also so learned in other fields, she also ends up serving almost informally as the convent's archivist and accountant, too.
Okay. Now, quick question. 'Cause I don't know if you know this. I don't think nuns get paid. They just get like free place to live and free, quote unquote, like food in order for their like service.
Sounds right to me.
So like she's doing all this extra stuff.
Well, I do think it's common for nuns to teach at like.
I'm more talking about being the accountant and archivist.
Yes. I suppose they, I don't know. I suppose to keep the places running, everyone probably had some like on the side jobs.
Yeah.
I don't know. But it makes
Okay.
sense to me. She did, of course, have her own like room and space, like you alluded to, Em, and apparently she collected a massive private library, one that was assumed to be one of the biggest private libraries in all of the New World. And amongst this library, which obviously is mostly books and those sorts of materials, she also had a lot of musical instruments and a bunch of scientific instruments as well. Remember, self-taught in all of these areas.
Love it.
Are you relating? Do you feel kinship with Sorwana?
Oh, I do. 100%.
So, what I found, one of the things I found interesting about her time at the convent is, as I alluded to earlier, she had a lot of freedom despite nominally being a nun in an institution that typically has a lot of rules and restrictions about what a nun could do. And this was because she remained really close with New Spain's government. They actually, not only like were patrons of her work, but they would like publish her scholarship back in Europe, in Spain. So they were very proud of her and kind of parading her work around quite a bit. So much so that she became the unofficial court poet in for like New Spain in the 1680s. And in this role, she would write plays and she would write poems and she would write, like religious songs. All of these things showcasing apparently the diverse writing styles and writing themes of the time. It was said that she drew from biblical sources and philosophy and mythology, and her styles ranged from satirical to comedic to purely religious. So, a Jill of all trades, if you will. But really impressive in terms of the vast styles and the vast subject matter that she was able to tap into, not just because of her lack of formal education, but also because she is fundamentally in this societal institution that doesn't necessarily allow for so many secular activities, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Like it's very clear even before you said that that she 100% would have had to have some like very special privileges to be able to do all of the things that she's doing and not just like dedicating her time to like reverence and prayer and that kind of stuff.
The way I think of it, and this is, I'm not a historian, but the way it makes sense in my brain is her going to the nunnery, to the convent, was like a formality. Like it was the she went there so that she didn't have to be pressured or judged into, marriage, stereotypical gender roles of the time, et cetera. It was like a formality for her to go to the nunnery, you know?
Okay, yeah.
So Sorana ends up becoming quite famous in both Mexico and Spain. And perhaps unsurprisingly, this doesn't go over super well with the religious community. They don't love how much time she's spending on these secular activities. And once her government patrons leave Mexico and go back to Spain, it kind of becomes open season for attacking Sor Juana and her activities. I would just say, like, in general, the religious community started coming after her by like 1690. And she fought back. She defended her secular studies as being really important for her full comprehension of theology and the religious studies. But by 1694, she ended up selling her library, renewing her religious vows, and kind of repenting or apologizing for, I guess, the things she was being accused of, basically not spending enough time on her religious duties, if you will.
Oh, okay.
There does seem to be some dispute over what led to her doing that, a couple of disputes potentially with high-level religious figures, or if there was some change of heart or what have you. It's not totally clear, but that's what ends up happening. Ultimately, her complete works, all of her writings comprise four volumes, and she was considered the last quote unquote great writer of the Hispanic Baroque period, which is part itself of the Spanish Golden Age. Sor Juana ended up passing away on April 17th, 1695, which would have made her around 44 years old. And this was during an epidemic. So she was taking care of her sick fellow nuns and then succumbed herself. But since this time, she's really become a national icon, a national treasure, perhaps, of Mexico.
I see what you did there.
But I mean, she's very famous in Mexico, s like statues all over. She's on Mexican currency, kind of a big deal. And I would argue, rightfully so.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like she contributed a ton to society. So, like, more power to her.
For sure. So what I want to do now is move into kind of the bulk most important part of this episode for our national treasure hunters listening in, which is Edge of History versus History. How well did Edge of History do here? And I'll be honest, we don't have a lot to go on because Sor Juana was mentioned so briefly, but I hate to compare this to Cross S. Nostrum in that the few lines that we do get, I think, say a lot.
Okay.
So the first big statement that Edge of History makes about Sor Juana is that she is the first feminist of the New World. That feels like something we can assess.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say just from like the surface, from all the facts you just gave, I feel like I generally would believe that. I'm
Yeah,
sure
so
there's like more nuance to it, but
spoiler alert, you are spot on. This is not something that Edge of History made up just for their narrative. I'll give you a couple of examples of some of that nuance. So, one of Sor Juana's famous poems, the English translation of the title is Foolish Men. It points out that men are like typically blaming women for things that are actually the men's fault, or that men criticize women for doing things that the men do themselves. So it's very much a, I would call it a call out.
It's giving me the Ben Franklin's letter vibes.
Mrs. Silence Do Good. She's doing great tonight, you guys. Yeah, it is kind of giving Mrs. Silence Do Good, but without the pen name and like fully putting your name behind it, because
Yeah.
that's how she rolled. Per Britannica Encyclopedia, Sor Juana's most significant, most impactful full-length plays also talk about the actions of really brilliant and daring women. But perhaps most importantly, Emily, this is the kind of the piece de resistance, if you will. In 1691, Sor Juana wrote a treatise of sort, like a letter defending all women's right to knowledge. This treatise is called, again, in English, Reply to Sister Philotea of the Cross. This was literally, she was writing it in response to a critique of her. And that critique was one of the times that she was being lambasted for her focus on secular studies. So she replied to that, being like very publicly, like an open letter almost, saying, all women have a right to knowledge. A famous quote from the treatise was, quote, one can perfectly well philosophize while cooking supper.
Damn.
Pretty good, right?
I'm gonna start using that.
She also in the treatise claims that the words of Saint Jerome and Saint Paul themselves imply that women have a right to education. So she's honestly using religious words against the religious figures who are criticizing her, which is
Oh yeah, and that's like something that I'm super familiar with. The idea of, like especially very like conservative religious people like framing things as one way and then take like somebody coming along and basically being like, let's actually look at what is said and what it means.
yeah.
And like use those words like against the points that they're making, but it's all coming from like the same texts, basically. Like, I love that.
It's really brilliant and particularly, I would say, bold given the time period in which she's operating, and bold given that she's writing this from inside of a convent.
Yes. Oh, for sure, for
You
sure.
know? Ultimately, according to poets.org, this treatise is considered, quote unquote, the first feminist manifesto. And after this treatise comes out, she would also end up writing a sung poem. I don't know how that's different from a song, but it was described as a sung poem about Saint Catherine of Alexandria, which is said by experts to sound way more feminist than religious in nature.
Okay.
So, Emily, to confirm your suspicions, by the late 1900s, she became known as the first published feminist of the New World. So, yes, this Edge of History statement is completely legit, and there's a lot of evidence to back it up.
Yeah, Edge of History. Yeah, Sor Juana. Love
Okay,
it.
well.
I feel like I'm going to be disappointed for the rest of the episode.
Well, this is a little bit of where me breaking Edge of History comes into play. So I wanted to reflect on my interpretation of the mention of Sor Juana in the show and how it was kind of invoked, like, oh, because this was Sor Juana's convent and she was the first feminist of the New World. Therefore, it makes sense that the box will be here in her convent. I wanted to think about that and ask, what did I believe she was part of the Daughters of the Plumed Serpent? Yes, I believed when watching the show that they were implying she was one of the daughters. Emily, I want to ask you to think really hard back to this scene and watching this episode. Did you assume that Sor Juana was a daughter of the Plumed Serpent?
I don't know if I went to that like level, but I definitely assumed she was the one that hid it in the organ, which I guess would make her a daughter of the Plume Serpent, like
Okay.
to be able to have done that.
Okay, so for me, that makes perfect sense. It's for me, it's really tough not to assume that she was a daughter when the premise of the show is Hispanic women in history being daughters of the Plumed Serpent. And then
True.
you bring up the name of a Hispanic woman in history and invoke her in the box conversation. I did also assume that she was directly involved in placing the box in the organ. So I'm glad we're on the same page. And I'm assuming a little behind the scenes baseball here. Have you looked at my notes for this episode
I've not
before?
looked at your notes for this episode.
Perfect. Excellent. So that, everyone, is my untainted experiment that Emily and I, who clearly think very differently about a lot of things, interpreted Sor Juana's reference the same way in this show. So I want to assess whether our assumption was right. So again, we're asking ourselves, was Sor Juana a daughter of the Plumed Serpent? Cross-referencing her personal history with the different indigenous groups that are invoked in Edge of History, Sor Juana lived in the former region of the Aztecs. But the Aztec Empire fell much earlier than her lifetime, namely in 1521, as we learned in our Hunt for Malinche episode. That being said, I would not be surprised if Sor Juana had Aztec ancestors, based number one on this geographic location. We're only talking about like a century here of difference in time. So we're not tons of distance from the Aztec Empire. But I also wouldn't be surprised if she had Aztec ancestors because it turns out that she actually had knowledge of the Nahuatl dialect. Do you remember Nahuatl?
I do.
So this was the Aztec language. And we'll get into more about the Nahuatl connection in a bit. Also, here's another point, a factor that she might have been very familiar with the Aztec, if not have Aztec heritage herself. One of Sor Juana's plays, in English titled The Divine Narcissus, it's a religious play and it combines Christianity and the Aztec religion.
Okay, so I'm buying it.
You buy it. All right. So if this is true, one might imagine that maybe Sor Juana was a daughter of the Plumed Serpent because we know that being a daughter of the Plumed Serpent was like passed down in families. in the story of Edge of History, much like being a daughter was passed down in Jess and Raphael's family, right? So, yes, Sor Juana very well could have been. I see in my notes, I abbreviate Daughters of the Plumed Serpent as DOPS. So, yeah, she could have been a DOPS.
Okay, so we're not wrong yet.
Right. All of that sounds great and consistent, except this doesn't explain why Sor Juana would be associated with the Lapis box. Recall, it's the Incan Lapis box that they end up finding in the organ. We would expect her to be associated with the obsidian Aztec box.
Okay, did she have any ties with the Incan box?
No.
Like, or did she have any, sorry, did she have any ties with Incan civilization?
No. I mean, geographically, she's not tied to that area, and there's no record of things like her knowledge of Incan language or anything like that. So that really doesn't make a ton of sense. Unless Sor Juana wasn't physically associated with the box being put there. In other words, other people would have put the box at her convent later, choosing the location in such a way that kind of uses Sor Juana as a symbol. Kind of like our characters are like, oh, Sor Juana, this was her convent. Of course a box should be there.
Yeah, like kind of in the same way that the, I guess the it doesn't fully line up, but like the builders of Heer Street,
The
right? Or
here.
De Heerstraat, did not like put the treasure under Parkington Lane.
Right, but the builders of De Heerstraat likely had absolutely nothing to do with the treasure, whereas people would have, like, the other, I guess what I'm saying is the other option here is people put it in the convent later because Sor Juana was a daughter of the Plumed Serpent during her lifetime. That's why it makes sense for people to be like, of course the box is in her convent. I actually buy that a little bit,
Okay.
especially because she has all these connections to the Aztec. But recall, Emily, do you remember that back when we actually did, oh gosh, I guess it would have been our recap and commentary on the second half of Edge of History, which was probably back in like season six, five? It was a while ago now. We question the temporal accuracy of the Sor Juana clue to begin with. We asked ourselves, like, what do we know about where the Lapis box was and when was it there? The Lapis box was in the Alamo, also known as Viesca, well. But the well was destroyed in the 1920s when a bank was
Bank.
built. Raphael breaks into the bank in the modern era, probably around 2001-ish in the early show. And he learned that the daughters had already moved the box. Also, the Meriwether Lewis Journal, written between 1804 and 1806, because that's when his expedition was. The Lewis Journal is what told them, the royal them, to go to the Alamo Well. So we should probably assume that the box was in the well around 1804. This would mean that Sor Juana herself had absolutely nothing to do with putting the box in the organ at the chapel. It can't. She cannot have had anything to do with the. She could not have placed it in the organ. Which is interesting because whoever put the box in the organ, they knew the Daughters of the Plumed Serpent lullaby. So someone who was a daughter obviously put it there. I think it's interesting that they invoked an organ. if it wasn't Sorwana who put it there, because Sorwana was musical. So it's almost like some rando dops came in decades later and was like, okay, Sorwana, let's just say Sorwana was a dops. So we're going to put the box in her convent in a specific object that people would associate with her. That's, I guess, the only way this makes sense.
I actually kind of buy that. I have a feeling you're not going to. But to me, that makes sense because if we think about the way that we assume things get passed down through the Daughters of the Plume Serpent, but also through, through the Knights Templar and Freemasons and how all of that stuff got passed down from generation to generation and all that, I think it makes sense that a future DOPS member could come and do this with the intention of putting it in a place where they knew Sorwana, who was another DOPS member, right? Kind of made her living and her impact. Like, to me, there's something very artistic and kind of full circle about that, and also makes it in a similar way to, I feel like, what happened with the Knights Templar and eventually the Freemasons, so that theoretically, the only people that should be finding this particular box would have to be DOPS themselves.
Right.
So to me, that all jives.
It makes it, I mean, we can make the argument, sure, and that would work with the timelines put forth in the show. I just find it really dissatisfying, mostly because of how little time they spend on Sorwana and the natural jump that dedicated viewers' brains make, right? We that's why we did this exercise at the beginning of this section. Did we assume that she was a DOPS and that she was involved with placing the box there? I think more people than not would say yes to both questions because they're not going to spend more time explaining what's going on here. But if we sit here and assess it like we have, who the heck put the box there? Who collected it from the bank? When did they get it from the bank before it was a bank? When did they put it there? Who was it that put it there? And they trusted the nuns with the knowledge that it was there? Because remember, the nuns knew about it. Like, it gives me so many more questions. If Sorwana had put it there herself, it would have made more sense to me that the nuns knew about it. It would have made more sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think I assume so. Yes, I assume the nuns were kind of like a confided in source because they don't have a ton of communication with the external world and all that kind of stuff. And they, from the sounds of it, made a very safe place for Sorwana as a daughter of the Plumed Serpent. I also think, looking back at the clue itself from that, Jess gets from her father, it doesn't actually say that Sorwana
Mm-mm.
was involved.
No, it never did.
And so I think, to your point, yes, casual viewers may make that jump, but if you look more closely at the clue itself, you really shouldn't be making that jump.
I hard disagree because they did not have to mention Sorwana.
I think it was another way to get history in, because otherwise you're just saying, like,
Right.
Daughters of the Plumed Serpent, and.
Totally, I totally agree. That's why they did it, but that's why it becomes confusing because they throw out this figure that again can be grouped amongst the figures like Malinche and the other indigenous women, and we associate them all as one thing. Like they could have solved the clue without ever mentioning Sorwana if she wasn't involved in the clue in some like meaningful way. The other question that I have for the record, where the heck did Raphael get the clue that he gave Jess? Throwing that out there. There is no
Her
answer to
mom.
that. We could. No, he had to have gotten the clue after he tried breaking into the bank because he thought it was in the bank.
Maybe they left a clue there.
We'll never know unless we ask the Wibberleys. So yeah, maybe we can follow up with the Wibberleys in some context. This really bugs me, this whole thing. And the real part that bugs me is the lapis box versus the obsidian box. And we're going to get to why I think that's so annoying as we wrap up. But before we wrap up, there are two other things that we need to talk about in terms of Edge of History versus history. I want to compare Sor Juana to La Malinche for a moment.
Okay.
Recall that La Malinche was born around 1500, which is more than 150 years earlier than Sor Juana's timeline. But we know that Malinche spoke Nahuatl, an Aztec language, and the songs that Sor Juana wrote mixed a number of dialects, including Hispano-African, Spanish, and Nahuatl. We also know that both figures were super smart.
Right.
Remember, Malinche was trilingual? Yeah, so she spoke Mayan, Nahuatl, and Spanish, and she was a really skilled strategist slash negotiator slash diplomat. And I mean, we've spent the early 10 minutes of this episode talking about how insanely brilliant Sor Juana was.
Yeah.
But what I really find interesting here, Malinche, remember, was and still is heavily criticized by some circles for abandoning her culture in favor of Spain. For those who might have missed our Malinche episode, the literal one-line SparkNotes version is La Malinche did so much translating and negotiating for Cortez that a lot of people think that she is like one of the biggest reasons, if not the biggest reason, Cortez was able to overthrow the Aztec Empire. So that's the Malinche side of this, 150-ish years before Sor Juana. 150 years later, Sor Juana seemed to wholeheartedly embrace the Spanish, even those governing figures who were like her biggest fans. And she's celebrated as a figure. Do you find that interesting?
Yeah. I will say, I think it's hard without knowing, like, a little more, I guess, like, concretely, like, having even more of, like, a full story of them as individuals. Something that hits me is it's possible that the time, like the temporal difference between when they were alive and doing these things, that might have been enough time for the, I'm going to use a weird term here that's not like consistent with the time period, but the news cycle to have shifted,
Yeah.
where it wasn't considered a bad thing anymore. It wasn't considered like as bad
Yeah.
anymore. And then that because that's how it was considered at the time, right? That it's not taken into a negative context in
Today.
present day.
Yeah, I actually don't think we need any more information on them because I feel like we know what they are known for, and that is what public perception is based on, what someone is known and remembered for. I think you're 100% right when it comes to the time period. We have to remember that Malinche's actions took place when the Aztecs, for lack of a better term, like still had a fighting chance, right? They were not taken over by the Spanish yet. And Malinche was seen as ha having been an active part of the reason why Spain did conquer the Aztecs. Now, Sor Juana comes around well after the Spanish had taken over. So she was just kind of living in this new Spain world from the get-go. Knowing what I know now about Sor Juana and how she was really celebrated for her brilliance, it does make me feel like Malinche really did, in some ways, get the short end of the stick. Like I argued in the Malinche episode that she was part villain for sure, and I still believe that. But she isn't fully given credit for how brilliant she was. I think we talked a little bit about that in the Malinche episode too. But like when you have a character like Sorwana who is given that credit and Malinche completely is not, it's a little rough.
Yeah, I mean, I like ultimately, I guess I agree. I think it's really unfortunate that they were not viewed in the same light, given their individual intelligences.
From the intelligence perspective, I think that's plenty fair. Of course, their actions are very different. It's kind of like comparing apples to oranges in terms of their
Yeah.
actions, but at least in terms of their smarts.
And we love smart women.
We love smart women. That's why we have so much intrigue around Billy in Edge of History. Anyway.
Another episode.
Last thing I want to assess here very quickly is this premise in Edge of History that Sorwana's convent was turned into a university. We actually talked about this in our Sadusky's Clue Room episode this season. But yes, Sorwana's convent, former convent, was indeed turned into a private university. You can like go there, visit, attend. It is called the University,
Attend.
the University of the Cloister of Sorwana. I think it's really poetic that her convent was turned into a university when you think about all she cared about was learning and scholarship and education. I think that's like beautiful history, full circle moment. The university itself actually is fairly young. It was opened in Mexico City's historic center in 1979, and it mostly covers the humanities M.
Oh, okay. That's
And
interesting because she did some like sciencey stuff, but okay.
they do have some sciencey stuff, but it is not predominant. And you know my shtick with maps this season of National Treasure Hunt.
Oh, yes.
The last thing I had to do here was take a look at good old Google Maps and confirm that the university is actually located at the intersection of streets named Isabel La Catalica and San Geronimo, or Queen Isabel and Saint Jerome. And part of Saint Jerome or San Geronimo actually is now pedestrian only and considered a plaza, like in front of the university. So all of that, super legit.
Okay.
So
Okay.
today, if anyone is kind of creating a map for themselves of places to go that are Edge of History related, you can visit this university. The site includes a museum because the cloister itself is a preserved historic site. So you can take a, I'm assuming you could take a tour very similar to Jess and her friends taking a tour.
Amazing. Maybe you can play the organ too. Probably not.
Probably not.
Boo. Is it even worth it then? Yes, it still is.
All right, well, that is our history lesson on Sorwana and our debate, if you will, about how Sorwana is integrated into the Edge of History story. Let's wrap up. Do you have any overarching thoughts? Did you learn anything? Do you have any questions? Questions, comments, concerns?
I mean, yeah, well, one, thank you so much for doing all of this research. I think my main kind of like reflection on this is that I feel this way about a lot of stuff in just the National Treasure franchise as a whole. I'm very happy to have had the opportunity to learn about Sorwana because I, like you said in the beginning of the episode, right? Like neither of us had heard of her before Edge of History. And I feel like, and I say this all the time, right? And we say this all the time, but I feel like one of the things that the National Treasure franchise just does so well is it brings in pieces of history that may otherwise be lost or overlooked, or it brings them to light in like a different context in a way that if you care enough, right, like you can get interested in it. Like I would not have looked into Soruana if we had not begun National Treasure Hunt, right?
Yeah.
But like having the opportunity to learn more about her, like now I want to go read more things about her. And so I think like the fact that she was at the kind of like intersection of this clue, right, that Jess's father, you know, passed on to her, and where they were able to find one of these boxes in Edge of History, I think it's really powerful because I think that it brings her to light and it brings her into like popular culture in a way where people can learn about her, where they wouldn't have done if her name was not at all affiliated with the like the clue itself. So I think that's my main thing, is that I'm just very thankful to the creative team for bringing her kind of into the clue and into the story.
Yeah, see, I fundamentally agree with you, but I do have some conflicting thoughts about that as part of my wrap up because I still can't wrap my head around why you would invoke Sorwana and make it sound like she was the reason the box was at the university when it's very clear if you dig into it that she had nothing to do with it. And so I like that they bring the name in so that we hear the name, but when you're just saying the name to say the name, like it's gonna take people like us to be like, who was that? And like to do our due diligence and read about it. It's kind of a little bit like how Malinche was used in Edge of History. Remember in our Hunt for Malinche episode, we argued that Malinche wasn't really central to the story at all, even though they lead you to believe she was.
Right.
So in this way, it's, I think the way they use Malinche and the way they use Sorwana in the show, it's name dropping. I would have loved to have seen a little bit more exploration of who these people are. I understand they have a time limit, they have 10 episodes, etc. But it just feels a little weird. It feels a little performative, maybe, to kind of drop these names and then not really integrate them. You know?
Could I do, and I understand what you're saying about like the name dropping. I'm wondering, and you, I could easily be completely wrong about this, if we would have similar opinions of like National Treasure and Book of Secrets and some of the names that are, you know, kind of thrown in there, if one, they weren't like white men who we've, you know, because we've grown up in American classrooms, we've learned their names our entire lives. And if we weren't so already like enmeshed in those things. So I'm thinking of like Charles Carroll of Carrollton, right? We love him on this podcast. He is great, right? But like they don't go into a ton of really in-depth stuff about him in the films. And real quick, because I know you want to say something before you do, another example is someone like, I think the person they referred to him in the movie was like Thomas Newman, Thomas Newton. It was that one part where they were telling the story about the, you know, one if by land, two if by sea thing. And they ended up, you know, we figured out that they ended up combining two people's names when they wrote that. And they just kind of like peppered the essentially they name dropped that, but didn't give us like a ton more information about them. And so I'm not saying that the like name dropping Sorwana and La Malinche is like not wrong, like that they shouldn't have gone into it more. But I'm questioning, I guess, like if we take a step back, did they also do that in
Yeah,
the films?
I don't think it's analogous at all because for Charles Carroll, they gave just enough information on him. They explained he was the last living signer. They explained that he was dying at this age. Like they integrated him into the story in a very meaningful way. Whereas So that's not really name dropping because he is now an actual part of the story. He is what I would think Malinche was supposed to be in a way. And then for the Thomas Newman Newton guy, he was also like we were told a story about him that was directly related to history. And I'll give another example, the Esteban story. They didn't have to bring up Esteban at all when they were talking about the City of Gold, but they literally read his story from a book. They didn't have to do that. So I just think the stories were crafted differently. And I also think that I would almost argue that if you're gonna name drop anyone and not give them the time of day to explore their story, you can get away with name dropping like a founding father dude. But you probably can't get away with just a name dropping like Malinche or Sor Juana because we don't know about them as people.
Or can you get away with it in a not great way? Because we don't know about those people, and therefore, inherently, people don't
They're not gonna
care
or
as
fact they're
much.
not gonna fact check you. That's actually a really good point. So it just bugs me that they took the liberty of us not knowing who Sor Juana was and wrote this line that makes most people think she was a dops and maybe she has something to do with this box. And I just feel like they didn't have to do that. They could have adjusted time periods, they could have adjusted minor details to make this fit. And I think all they had to do to fix the crux of the problem here was to swap the obsidian and the lapis boxes. Allow me to explain. We didn't do any hunting as an audience or as an observer to find the obsidian box. The Sadduskis already had it. It was in the little globe at the Masonic Lodge. Why not make them have possession already of the lapis box? After all, the Incans are the hardest of the three civilizations to logically tie into the history part of this treasure hunt anyway. Why not make them have the lapis box at the Masonic Lodge and make the obsidian Aztec box the one found at the university in the chapel?
That's a good
And
idea.
right, I mean, and viewers, listeners, do not at me. I know this doesn't solve the Sor Juana in the 1600s and Lewis journal in the 1800s problem, but I think you could still get away with this if you said that the box was hidden in the well, transcribed in the Lewis journal in the early 1800s, but by that point, the box had already been moved, and that info just hadn't gotten back to North America, to Lewis, to Sacagawea, to York yet. And all I think all you had to do was swap the obsidian and lapis boxes, because no matter what argument we make, M, it really doesn't make a ton of sense in a fictional story why you would put the Incan box in a place associated with a potentially Aztec character.
Yeah, it's making me wonder if that was just like an oversight or if there was an intentional
No idea.
reason behind that. But yeah, that's really interesting. Well, if you too are wondering about this, please talk to us about it. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at NT Hunt Podcast. We're also available at nthuntpodcast.com. And please join our Patreon at patreon.com/nthuntpodcast for even more national treasure related content.
We hope you've enjoyed this deep dive into the life and times of Sor Juana. And Emily, congratulations on completing the penultimate episode of season 8.
And to you as well, m'lady.
Well, thank you so much, my dear. Our next episode will, of course, be our season 8 finale. And as always, you're getting an expert interview, but we ain't gonna tell you who it's with. You're
Yeah, I gotta show up.
just gonna have to come back and find out. So get excited. And until then, I'm Aubrey.
I'm Emily.
And thank you so much for joining us on our National Treasure Hunt.